Hey, welcome back to the second session of the Stop Self-Sabotage System. I'm your head coach, Howard Jacobson. So in the first session, we covered the first of the three big mindset issues, mindset problems that keep people from gaining traction at the early stages. So someone will have this moment of motivation, of inspiration to change what they're doing. Right. Maybe it's a health scare of your own, a lab test, a clinical symptom, a talk with someone. Maybe it's someone else's health scare that convinces you, or maybe it's getting on a scale and seeing a certain weight. Whatever it is, you've had an initial motivation to change, to do something differently, and then very early in the process, you fall off the wagon. Or that's how you think about it. And there's the wagon of health, the wagon of well-being rolling down the road, too far away for you to catch up. You're on the ground, you bumped your head, you've skinned your knee, you're sitting on your ass, lying in the dirt, falling off the wagon, and there goes the wagon. Well, you can see how that metaphor itself is pretty disempowering. Like, it assumes there's a wagon and that the wagon is moving without you, and you can't just get up and continue on your way. You wouldn't say, I've fallen off the sidewalk, if you just fall down or trip or stumble, and you just get right back up and keep going, right? So these huddles, we're talking about the three mindset issues that get people stuck in the early stages and having them give up. And so the next time they have an even greater motivation to overcome the inertia, they've also got this additional albatross of past failure. So the motivation needs to get higher and higher and higher to overcome our perceived lack of ability to do it, our lack of self-efficacy. So I want to break that cycle right now and forever with you. So last week we talked about insistence on perfection as the big primary problem. That when we start making this change, we're impatient. We think we need to change everything all at once because the motivation comes with an urgency to it. And therefore, we get into all sorts of trouble by pushing too hard, too fast, attempting to do the impossible, and then giving up. So today's mindset shift is based on that insistence on perfection. In fact, it's a very close corollary, and it's called misinterpreting failures. Misinterpreting failures. So if you insist on perfection and you're discouraged when you don't achieve perfection, that means that you have given failure a particular meaning. And it's a meaning that may become a self-fulfilling prophecy, so you can look back and say, well, I was right. But it doesn't mean it's the only interpretation, and it doesn't mean it's the most powerful or useful interpretation. So what we're going to be talking about today is how to interpret failure along the way, even early stage, even the first time you try to eat better and you find yourself binging on something that's outside of your plan. Or the first time you decide, okay, tomorrow morning I'm going to wake up early and I'm going to go for a walk, and then you sleep in and you don't do it. And the natural thing to do is to interpret the failure in the light of this desire for perfectionism. Not the only desire for perfectionism, but an insistence, a demand for perfectionism. And this is perhaps a good time to remind you of my friend Michael Edelstein, psychologist, definition of disordered thinking, which is mistaking a preference for a demand. So, of course, we have this preference to do it right, to not screw this one up, to make progress as quickly as possible, to be perfect. But making that into a demand means that we don't give ourselves another choice, we don't give ourselves another option, and failure becomes unacceptable, and therefore it becomes proof of our essential brokenness, so that the failure extends beyond this particular incident. So our behavior didn't match our expectations. The outcome wasn't what we wanted. but we extend that and create a blanket statement to say that we are a failure, as opposed to this particular moment, this particular critical moment, this particular issue didn't go the way we wanted. So let's begin. So the first is a myth. And the myth is that failures mean that we're failing. And I learned this a long time ago, and I'll tell you two different stories in which I really learned that failures are not signifiers of global failure, but actually signifiers of the potential for great success. So the first example comes from my many years of teaching people how to juggle. And before that, of course, learning how to juggle myself. And if you know how to juggle three items, let's say three balls or bean bags, you know that there's a certain thing that we do when we're trying to learn that gets in our way. And I'll try to describe it to you a little bit, which is let's say you're juggling one ball, which is called throwing and catching to yourself, right? So you have the ball in your left hand, you toss it up in the air, you catch it with your right hand, and then you do the same thing in the other direction. So that's very, very simple. Now, when we do two balls, we have one in each hand. Let's say you throw the ball in your left hand first. It's up in the air, and it's going to come down and land in your right hand. So what you want to do is empty your right hand so you can catch the ball. And what people do when they do two balls is they'll throw the first ball up in the air with their left hand, and then they'll quickly take the ball in their right hand and pass it to their left hand, so their right hand is now open and ready to catch the ball. And they'll just keep doing that. Throw with the left, pass from the right to the left, catch with the right. And when you do it quickly enough, it kind of looks like juggling with two balls. The trouble is when you add a third ball, that no longer works. Because let's say you start with your left hand, which means you start with two balls in the left hand, one in the right. So you throw one of the balls from the left hand up in the air. It's coming down into your right hand, and your right hand wants to pass the ball to your left hand, but your left hand has another ball in it. It's not open. The correct thing to do here is to throw the right hand ball up in the air too, so that it's throw, throw, catch, and then you just keep on doing that so that you're always throwing to empty a hand before you have to catch the ball that's about to descend. The problem is when we start doing that, we get overexcited. We focus on trying to catch instead of making good throws, and so our throws go all over the place. We're just like tossing the ball anywhere just to open up our hand to catch the one that's coming down because we're so focused on the catch. Now, that was a long introduction, but the point is that when people start learning how to juggle, they are going to drop the ball. And the thing that people want to do more than anything is not drop the ball. They just want to catch it. Wherever it goes, however far they throw it, you'll see people trying to learn how to juggle, and they will lunge all over the place, just trying to make sure the ball doesn't hit the ground. When, in fact, the ball hitting the ground, and let's say it's a beanbag, so it doesn't even roll. When you throw a beanbag and you're trying to juggle, you want it to land right on your hand. You don't want to have to move your hand, wave around, sway, lunge. You just want it to land exactly where your hand is so you can be as efficient as possible. So when you throw it and the beanbag lands behind you, then you've gotten some feedback. You've learned something from that failure. And so by learning something, the next time you make a throw, you consciously say, I'm going to see if I can not throw this behind me, but throw it up in the air straight ahead of me. And then you'll find that you do it again. It's behind you. And so eventually you figure out, all right, well, I'm going to think about throwing it in front of me. And then it starts coming down right where you want it. So every single drop is not a calamity or a source of frustration or failure. Every single drop can be feedback to help you do it better next time. And that's how people who learn juggling learn. They let go of the fear of dropping the ball. And the sooner they let go of that fear of dropping the ball, the sooner they start focusing on making better throws, even if they don't do it on purpose. So the second place I saw this in my life was, for many years, I was a school teacher at a small Quaker school in Princeton, New Jersey. And one of the things that I found most amazing and remarkable and clever about the way the school taught was the way they did writing. And a lot of us remember we would write something and would be kind of meaningful to us, and then it would come back with the teacher's red pen all over it, crossing words out, asking rhetorical questions, pointing out spelling errors, having all those editor's marks for carrots that you missed a word here, or you spelled something wrong there, or used the wrong tense. And basically it comes back to us and it's like they've shit all over it with red pen. It's no longer ours. And at the same time, you have to do spelling words. And so whenever you get a word that's misspelled, you get points off on your essay, and then you've got to do your spelling lessons all by themselves. So here's how Princeton Friends School did it differently. Instead of writing all this negativity on your paper, the only corrections could be made on a Post-it. So it didn't land on your paper directly, it was on a Post-it. And all of the spelling errors were written down on this Post-it. And still you'd think, well, they're punishing me, they're telling me all about my errors, they're giving me negative feedback. Except that the school also had a policy that every student had to learn 10 words to spell every single week. And it was kind of a pain in the butt to go find those words. You know, you'd be reading something and then you'd have to choose a hard word that you didn't know or you didn't recognize, and then you'd look it up and then you'd do all the stuff to it to learn how to spell it. But it was effort. But when you misspelled a word in an essay or a piece of creative writing and the teacher wrote down the correct spelling of the word for you on that Post-it, they just did your work for you. Students were so happy to get those spelling errors on their Post-its so they could add the words to their spelling list and come up with their 10 words that week without having to go do all this extra effort. So the school was able to turn what could have been indication of failure into something that students really appreciated and were able to see that what could have been seen as a failure, a mistake, was actually a way to leapfrog the learning. And just to formalize this concept in education, professor of education Roger Shank has provocatively claimed that all learning is actually expectation failure. That the only time we learn anything is when we have an expectation that isn't met. And when you think about it for just a couple of seconds, you can see how true it is. So if I do something, if I go through an experience and everything happens exactly the way I expect it to, well, then obviously I haven't learned anything new. I've just reinforced old beliefs, old knowledge. But when something goes awry, that's when I learn something new. So, for example, when I lived in New Jersey and was driving around, this was in the era before GPS, before navigation systems, so I would learn how to drive places either from maps or people would give me directions, and I would just get lost every so often, you know, make wrong turns. But I really ended up with a map of the area where I was living in my head. Like, I knew how to get from anywhere to anywhere. But as soon as we got a car with GPS and then we moved to North Carolina, I never really learned how to get from Durham to Chapel Hill. I never really learned how to navigate downtown Durham or how to get to Raleigh or where exactly Cary and Apex were or how to get to the Trader Joe's or to the Asian market and all that stuff. Because I no longer had any of these expectation failures because the GPS was just telling me what to do so my mind could shut down. And I've had a similar experience, been trail running in a local neighborhood for the past several months. And I've just gone with a friend who lives there, who knows the trails. And so he leads and I follow, and I have no idea where we are ever. Like, if he, you know, ducked out into the woods and left me by myself, I don't know that I could find my way back. I would end up somewhere eventually, but I don't know that I could find my way back. So one day I went to run with him and I was late, and I had said earlier the previous evening, that I might sleep in, I might not be able to make it. So he didn't wait when I was late. And so there I was at the trailhead, and I decided, well, I'll try to run it anyway. And just to make sure I didn't get hopelessly lost, I created an algorithm. I said, I'm always going to take the right turns. every right I'm going to take, I'm going to go as far as I feel like it. And then when I come back, I'm going to take all the left turns. So that way I should be able to find my way back to the parking lot. And when I did that, I started running and I started noticing areas where we had run before. But now all of a sudden, I had a mental framework for those places. And so now each of those places, the bridge the wooden bridge with all the plywood on it, the place next to the skateboard ramp, the parking lot where you have to cross the road and go up that little embankment, all those places I had run several times, but they were all pieces of a jigsaw puzzle in the box. I didn't know where they fit. And now from this one run, I have a really decent sense of where they all fit in relation to each other because I didn't know what I was doing. And every time I came to a new turn, I was like, oh, so this is where this is. And I experienced expectation failure multiple times on this run. Okay, so I hope you can see that mistakes and failures don't mean that we are failing globally. So when we try to instill a behavior change, expect when we don't insist on perfection, we know we're going to make mistakes. We know we're going to backslide. We know things are not going to go perfectly 100% smoothly. So once we stop interpreting them as global failures, the next step is to get honest about our failures and to do the kind of analysis and diagnosis that can help us the next time. So for diagnosis, we're going to use BJ Fogg's behavior model. And I've talked about this at length in previous huddles, and we're going to be talking about it specifically next week. So I'm not going to go into the details of the model except to point out the three areas on the right side of the equation that determine whether a behavior gets done or not. And those are motivation, ability, and trigger. And so let's start with motivation, which is your desire to do the behavior or not. So let's say you were invited to a potluck at a neighbor's house and you are worried about eating food off plan. There's going to be a lot of meat dishes there and they're going to be grilling hot dogs and hamburgers, and you know the smell always gets you, but you're saying, okay, well, I don't want to eat that stuff. I want to eat healthy veggies. Cool. So then you go to the potluck, you bring a salad, you have some of the salad, and then you're walking around, and then you say, well, the burger smells so good. I'll just take a quarter of a burger sitting on the plate there. And then you take it, and then, well, you might as well get the fixings with it. And so you put it on a bun, and you add all the other stuff, and you eat it, and then you end up eating three more burgers, two hot dogs, and chicken salad. And so now you're like, oh, well, I failed, right? The old insistence on perfection and misinterpretation of failure. So now we're going to do an end run around that misinterpretation. So we're going to say the failure in this instant doesn't mean I'm a failure, but let's figure out why it happened. So let's start with motivation. So was my motivation, it could be either completely gone, it could be temporarily forgotten in the heat of the moment, or there could be ambivalence due to competing motivation that ended up overpowering the motivation to eat right. So we can say, well, was it completely gone? No, because we started with a quarter of a burger, an eighth of a burger. So there was motivation to eat right. And I even brought that motivation with me because I had a salad pre-made and I brought it and I thought about it in advance. Okay, now, did I temporarily forget about my motivation? Well, actually, at the end, I kind of did. You know, when I was binging on my three burgers and two hot dogs, at that point, I wasn't even in touch with it. But before then, I hadn't really forgotten it. I had made some sort of deal with the devil, right? I'm going to have this little bit, and that's all I'm going to have, and that will be enough. And then once I had it, I had an attack of the what the hell effect. Oh, well, I've broken it. I've screwed up. I fail. I've fallen off the wagon. There goes the wagon trundling up the hill. I'll never catch up. I might as well binge on processed meat. Right? Or was the problem with motivation ambivalence due to a competing motivation? And that's probably what it was right there. So the motivation to eat healthy was still there, but there was another motivation caused by the craving for the food and maybe a desire to fit in and not have to explain why I'm not having the grilled meat with everybody else. So there were these competing motivations. So the next thing to get honest about is, was it an issue of ability? You know, was my motivation high, but I simply made it too hard on myself? And so again, following BJ Fogg, we're going to look at six different factors that play into ability or the ease in which you're able to do a behavior. So was there not enough time? So sometimes we cave because we don't have enough time. So for example, if I don't go running in the morning, it might be because I've got too much to do and I say, well, I didn't have time to do my run. Or I didn't have time to make my salad jars for the week, so I ended up being very vulnerable to cafeteria food or going out to eat or picking up some junk food at the gas station convenience store. Okay. Now, in this case, it really wasn't an issue of time. I had time to make the salad, and there was plenty of time to make good choices at the potluck itself. A second factor related to ease or ability is money. Sometimes if we don't have enough money, it's harder to do things. If we can't afford certain foods or the convenience of certain foods, or we don't live, you know, we live in an area where there isn't a convenient grocery store with a good produce section. You know, so lack of money could be an issue. It doesn't sound like that was the issue here with the potluck, though. Now, is it a mental issue, sort of like brain cycles, not enough free brain cycles to focus on it? So you think of it as lacking focus or attention or willpower. You say, well, maybe, you know, I had an early lunch that day and I was a little bit annoyed at something. I was focusing on an insurance bill that I didn't think I should have to pay, and I was going to have to call up and do a big fight and balagan with, and like maybe our mind wasn't fully present. Okay. Another factor leading to diminished ability is if something is too hard to do physically. Like if the salad is, you know, up a ladder and it's hard for me to climb the ladder, to use a silly example, I won't be able to do it. Or if, you know, the healthy food is in the mud room on a shelf and I have all this crap in the way and a bicycle and a couple of rear car seats and it's just hard to get to the stuff, I'll probably do the thing that's easier. So this is an area in which physically difficult bleeds into the issue of not enough time. Like it only takes me 5 seconds to get the Clif Bar from the kitchen pantry, but it might take me 2.5 minutes to get the dried beans from the mudroom. All right, another issue of ability and ease is social pressure. Was it too hard to overcome the social pressure of the gathering? And social pressure can be, you know, overt, where people are actually saying things like, oh, come on, just have one. It's not going to kill you. I just read something that said that bacon is the fountain of youth and hot dogs aren't nearly as bad as cigarettes and it's only once a year and live a little or whatever. Okay, then there can be implied social pressure where nobody says it outright, but everyone's, you know, eating it. And if you don't, you might get some, you know, raised eyebrows or innocent, innocuous comments that imply that you're not following what the group is doing and therefore some sort of psychological threat. And of course, there's imagined social pressure where we just see other people doing something and we feel like they must be judging us, even though they probably don't give a shit in the least. And finally, what BJ calls non-routine. So something is so far out of your routine or comfort zone, it's so far out of what you would naturally do as a default that it takes extra energy and care and intelligence and the ability to tolerate being bad at something and being awkward at it and being unsure of yourself and confused. So anything that's too far out of your routine or comfort zone. And in this case, you know, probably not. Probably you could have gotten by with your salad and some of the fixings, you know, sliced tomato and lettuce and onion and relish, and even put it on a bun if you like. So there, it wasn't like you, in this case, you know, were so far out of your comfort zone that you couldn't figure out how to not have a burger. Okay, so we've covered motivation and ability. Now let's look at the third element, the trigger. So the trigger is something in the environment that reminds us to behave in a certain way. So in this case, you know, a trigger could be non-existent. It could just be no trigger. So the other morning, I was going to get up at 5 so that I could do a workout with a friend at 6. And I was up at 4:15, and I decided to go back to sleep for 45 minutes. And when I'd gotten up at 4:15, I thought I was going to stay up, so I turned off my alarm. And then when I went to sleep, I didn't wake up till like 7:08 because I didn't have a trigger. You know, there was a non-existent trigger to get me to wake up. Sometimes the trigger exists but isn't noticeable enough. So if I say, well, one trigger for me to remember to floss every day is that I have the floss on the counter. And when the counter gets cluttered and there's floss and there's a bunch of other stuff, then the floss hides. It's not noticeable enough, and so I might not remember because the trigger was hidden. The trigger can exist and not be intense enough. So, for example, you know, if it's a soft alarm as opposed to a loud alarm, or something, you know, let's say you download this app and it's supposed to remind you to be mindful or to check in 7 times a day, and the first few times you hear the distinct noise that the smartphone makes, you pay attention to it, but after a while, it fades into the background. So the intensity drops as you accommodate to it, as you get used to it. And finally, the trigger could be unreliable. So when it's there, it's great, but often it's not there, and so you simply don't trust it. So what was the trigger at this potluck? Well, there probably wasn't a particular trigger except your desire to remember, but you didn't really assign ahead of time a specific trigger to remind you to not do it. So it doesn't seem like the trigger was really the issue here. This was an issue of a combination of motivation and ability. Okay, so now that we have that general basic diagnosis, we're going to reinterpret the failure. So in its essence, a failure is a learning opportunity. And in the spirit of the book Organize Tomorrow Today, which I've talked about on several of these huddles so far, we're going to interpret those failures as learning opportunities, as fight-throughs, as chances to either move forward and develop a new level of skill and commitment and ease with a new habit or behavior, or an opportunity to slip back into the default, the existing easy default behavior. And you can think of it like, you know, climbing up a mountain. If you suddenly run out of energy and you just get into a ball, you'll just roll back down the mountain with, you know, your potential energy translates into kinetic energy in one direction only, down, back to where you came from. Whereas if you continue to put energy into it another step, you move up closer towards the top of the mountain. So in Organize Tomorrow Today, they talk about the 3 stages of habit change. The first stage is the honeymoon, where you're all committed, you're highly motivated, and even if it's hard, you just do it. And then at a certain point, life throws you curveballs, or things just get hard, or you get tired of it, or your motivation wanes, and that's what the stage they call fight through. And the fight through, as I said, it's a chance to either slide back or to overcome this new obstacle and develop a new level of ability. The third stage is what they call second nature, where you can just do it easily. It's not hard anymore. And what they say that I think is just so brilliant is that you can't go from honeymoon directly to second nature. It's the fight through stage that gets you there. It's the fight through stage that provides the rocket fuel to help you break out of orbit and suddenly be free to accomplish this new habit on a regular basis. And the fight throughs, you don't have to win all of them. In fact, I don't recommend that you win all of them. I think you should go for a B-, 80%. You should try to win 4 out of 5. Why? Because if you're winning 5 out of 5, that means you're not trying hard enough. You're not choosing behaviors that are challenging enough to really get you where you want to go. You're leaving a lot of potential on the table. I just heard an interview with a journalist, Jesse Eisinger, who wrote a book on corporate crime and why almost nobody was prosecuted after the 2008 financial meltdown. And he told a story about James Comey, who took over the job of U.S. attorney in Manhattan in 2002. And one of the first things he did was call a meeting of all the line attorneys, and he asked the prosecutors to raise their hands if they had never, ever lost a case. And this was the hot shot. This was where the best prosecutors in the United States went to hone their chops. And a bunch of them raised their hands and said, yep, we've never, ever lost a case. We're 100% winners. And Comey said to them, we have a name for prosecutors like you who've never lost a case. We call them the Chicken Shit Club, because you're too scared to go after things you might lose. So not to belittle anybody's efforts, but it's an interesting way to think about if you win all your fight throughs, you're probably not trying to accomplish big enough, great enough, important enough things. So you're staying in some sort of a comfort zone out of a desire to avoid failure. So then going back and understanding how to interpret failures will allow you to be okay with failure, to be okay with losing some fight throughs, and in fact, to look forward to setting up fight throughs that are challenging enough that you do lose some of them. So this is related now to the work of Carol Dweck on mindset, where if you believe that you have a growth mindset and that you can grow and change, then anytime you fail at something, it's evidence that you've learned something new and you're on the way to doing better next time. As opposed to if you have a fixed mindset, then if you fail at something, that's evidence that you are a failure yourself. So once we understand that we're not failing just because we fail at individual things, and then we get honest about our failures and we look at them in terms of what was missing, motivation, ability, a trigger, some combination, and then we think about opportunities for success or failure as fight throughs, as a chance to move as quickly as possible from honeymoon to second nature. So now, once we have the fight throughs, we then anticipate them so that we're not just fighting last year's battle or last month's battle or last week's battle, but we're looking ahead and we're anticipating what are the fight throughs that are likely to come up in the next hour, day, week, month, quarter, year, so that we can do something about them. And the method we're going to use here comes from a book called Decisive by Chip Heath and Dan Heath. The subtitle is How to Make Better Choices in Life and Work. And it's called Bookending the Future. So basically, say, well, the future doesn't exist yet as a reality, but it exists as a range of possibilities. And so we're going to look at the high and low of that range. So the first step is to identify some critical moment. So let's say there's going to be another potluck next month. Another neighbor is having a similar deal, or the same neighbor. And you're just going to get a chance to basically repeat this critical moment. So now the first step is to imagine just the worst case scenario. You know, so if you have a range, you know, maybe the worst case scenario is exactly what you did last time, where you end up totally binging on hamburgers and processed meat and chicken salad. And then maybe you even end up with like 5 or 6 cannolis for dessert that somebody brought in the Tupperware. So you want to imagine the worst case scenario. Then watch the movie of it in your mind. So you can close your eyes and actually as best you can, see what you see, hear what you hear, smell what you smell, watch your behavior, and then you're going to ask yourself a question. You're going to say, so you just binged at this potluck. What are all the reasons this might have happened? Think about all the reasons this might have happened. And then you can make a list of them. Things like, I didn't eat beforehand. I stood next to the grill where the smell was really close to me. I didn't have anybody much to talk to, so I was kind of bored and looking for something to do with my hands. I didn't come with anybody who was going to hold me accountable. You know, and just come up with all the reasons that this thing might have happened. Write them down. Next, imagine the best case scenario where you do exactly what you want to have done. And then you watch that movie in your mind and give it as much clarity and vividness. Use all your senses. Really bring yourself there as if you're watching the movie, or maybe it's a video game, a first-person video game, and you're actually seeing it and experiencing it for yourself. And then you're going to go through the same questioning process. Now, you've eaten totally according to plan at this potluck. Think about all the reasons this might have happened. And then you might discover the number of reasons are sort of the obverse. Well, I had a giant bowl of salad and with rice and beans before I went over there, so I wasn't even hungry. I decided that the purpose of the potluck was just to be social and not to eat at all, so I didn't even hang out near the food table. I knew a neighbor, another friend of mine was going to be there, and I asked him to be my sort of chaperone. Said, my intention is not to eat this stuff, but sometimes I'm a little bit weak. Can I let you know so that you can kind of keep an eye on me and remind me in subtle ways if I'm starting to look like I'm going to break my word here? And whatever else you can think of, all the reasons, all the things you did. So then, with the two scenarios bookended, that's when you make your plan. And the plan is of the moves you're going to make based on the triggers that you expect to find at the party. So that the triggers that already exist, whether it's the booze table or the dessert or the barbecue grill or the badminton set, whatever it is, or when people coming up to you and saying things or offering you things, you're going to plan your when-then moves. And a when-then move is basically a sentence that goes when, dot, 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 then I do, dot, dot, dot. When someone comes up to me with a hamburger fresh off the grill and offers it to me, I will say, no thanks, I'm sticking to salad today. Or, oh, no thanks, I'm saving room for the peach pie. Or whatever it is, whatever deflection. Or I'm not even going to answer and just say, wow, that looks really good. Thank you so much for inviting me. This is such a great party, right? Whatever technique you're going to use, you script it in advance so that when the trigger comes up, you don't have to think. You don't have to decide. You've already pre-decided that this is your only move when that trigger occurs. And the final step in stopping the misinterpretation of failures is to learn from the failures so that your fight-throughs that you lose become, as Roger Shanks says, expectation failure that leads to learning. So this is when we use Peter Bregman's FAST assessment. And the FAST assessment, as I've spoken about so many times in these huddles, is an acronym for Feel, Act, Say, Think. So what did I feel at that moment? And so we're looking at the FAST assessment from a particular failure, and we want to look at the exact moment of failure. We don't want to be vague about it and say, well, I overate at the party. Say, well, what was the moment, the critical moment, that point in time where things could have gone either way and they went south? It was that time that when I decided I'll just have an eighth of a burger. I'll just have a little bit of that delicious, juicy meatiness with a bunch of fixing, and that's all I'll do. Right now, if you had that eighth and that was all you had and you were fine with it and it was according to your eating plan and you were peaceful about it, then maybe that's not a problem. It only becomes a problem if you discover that you ended up doing what you didn't want to do. And then we go back and we look for what was the root moment that led to it. So at that moment that you decided, so maybe it wasn't the eighth, maybe it was the second burger that you had. when you're trying to decide, okay, so maybe it was, how did I feel? I felt disappointed that I'd had some already, even though I told myself that I could have a little bit of meat at this party, and I decided to do it. But then what did I think? I thought, oh, well, I've kind of blown it, and I might as well just have some more. So that was the thought. What did I say? I said, okay, well, you know, let me, you know, maybe I didn't say anything to anybody else. Maybe I said to myself, oh, one more. It's only, you know, I only go to these. I don't cook them at home. It's really delicious. And maybe it's, you know, farm, you know, humane, grass-fed, whatever, massaged cows. And so you convince yourself that it was okay. How did I act? I went to the grill, and as soon as the next burger came off, I grabbed it. How did I feel? I felt sort of excited, and I had this craving for it. It was kind of an uncomfortable feeling. I felt some guilt along with that, but also like I couldn't help myself. I felt out of control. Okay, so then we can learn from that past failure so that we then can inform our worst and best case scenarios when we bookend the future. And then when the when-then move comes, say, okay, well, here's that feeling again. So now I'm craving the burger. And last time I felt out of control and anxious and like I couldn't control the craving. And I thought, oh, well, I've already blown it, so let me just give in. So next time my when-then is going to be, when I feel that craving, I'm going to say to myself, this is just a wave. It's a set of body sensations, and it comes and it goes. And if I don't act on it, it will go away. So I'm going to tell myself that, and then I'm going to distract myself. I'm going to walk away from the food, and I'm going to go play a game, or I'm going to go for a walk, or I'm going to find someone to talk to about something completely unrelated to hamburgers. So that's how we stop early stage self-sabotage when the inevitable failure occurs, by first of all understanding that individual failures are pathways, stepping stones to success, maybe even trampolines to success, and they're not signifying the end of the process, or that we're bad people, or that we are hopeless, or that we lack self-discipline, willpower, motivation, drive, grit, persistence, passion, whatever. It just means that we're on a path and that we're growing. Then we get honest about our failures and we look at the reasons why. Then we reinterpret those failures as fight-throughs, learning opportunities that we're going to require some willpower and grit and effort, but that we can do, we can win. And then finally, to anticipate those fight-throughs by bookending the two futures, the most desirable, the best-case future and the worst-case future, and then thinking about all the reasons this might have happened and planning our when-then moves to install positive triggers in challenging environment. And finally, learning every time we fail, do a Peter Bregman's FAST assessment and add that information into our when then moves. All right, so that's it for the second part of stopping early stage self-sabotage. In the third part, we're going to talk about actually something pretty paradoxical and counterintuitive, which is what happens when we misinterpret success and why does that get us in trouble. But otherwise, just keep working on this stuff. You should have the mind map to, you can print out and go through. And I didn't stop the recording this time with those little musical interludes. So, but you have a pause button, I assume, and you can stop this at any point. And actually, I would listen to this again and then stop it to go over the different parts about getting honest about failures and checking in with motivation, ability, and the trigger, to anticipate the fight-throughs through the bookending process. So to identify a critical moment and then actually stopping the recording and imagining that worst-case scenario, writing down reasons, and then imagining the best-case scenario and writing down those reasons, and then planning a bunch of when then moves and writing it down. And then you can, you know, practice fast assessment just any time anything doesn't go perfectly. So the more you practice it, even on the little things, even when you did almost like you did 99% instead of 100, well, the smart money is on the person who wants to learn from that 99% success and get it to 100% by doing the fast assessment. That's what Matthew Syed calls black box thinking in his book, Black Box Thinking, which is about why the airline industry, aviation, keeps on improving and getting safer and safer over the years, whereas medicine, which doesn't have black boxes and doesn't have a culture of looking at and learning from mistakes, tends to not improve very much from year to year in terms of habits and behaviors leading to unnecessary morbidity and mortality. All right, well, that's it for this week's Healthy Habit Huddle. I hope you found this useful. If you would like more help, I've got a whole bunch of private coaching options, and we have the Big Change Program, which is the best of individual coaching and group work and self-paced learning and change. It's amazing. The first cohort that started in August 2016 is just coming to a close, and it's just amazing to look back over the year and see the progress that folks have made. It's really inspiring. It's inspiring to me and Josh as the leaders, and I know it's inspiring to members of the Big Change Program, many of whom are now graduating to become teachers themselves, if not in a formal sense, then at least, you know, lights, lighthouses, advocates, beacons for a healthy plant-based lifestyle that other people can see what it's done for them and want some of that too. All right, so that's it for this week. We'll see you next week when we talk about how to interpret and how not to misinterpret successes in the early stages of behavior change. That's it. Be well, my friends.